Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books and Chinese Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Suvi Rautio, and I'm one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we are joined by linguist, anthropologist, and interdisciplinary ethnographer in the Department of Anthropology and Sociology at Zhejiang University, Professor Jay Kerschut. Jay is joining me to talk about his book, Anglocene, Compromised Personhood in Afro-Chinese Translations, published in 2023 by University of California Press. Anglocene examines Afro-Chinese interactions within Beijing's aspirationally cosmopolitan student class. Jay Kerschut explores the ways in which contemporary interactions between Chinese and African university students are mediated through complex intersectional relationships with whiteness, the English language, and cosmopolitan aspiration. At the heart of these tensions, a question persistently emerges. How does English become more than a language and whiteness more than a race? Engaging in this inquiry, Kerschut explores 21st century Afro-Chinese encounters as translational events that diagram the discursive contours of a changing transnational political order, one that will certainly be shaped by African and Chinese relations. I will be discussing the book in more detail with Jay Kerschut, who I have the pleasure of joining me on the show today. Jay, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Suvi. This is such a tremendous honor and pleasure. I enjoy this podcast very much. I've listened to a few episodes of it, so I'm fabulously honored to be here.
I'm honored to have you here. So to begin the show, as we usually do, I want to ask you about what led you to study African educational migrants in China.
So I think I should start by saying that, you know, I myself am a South African. Initially, my encounter with the types of students that you see me engaging in the book, obviously, I don't only talk about African students, but also their Chinese interlocutors, student peers and teachers. But my entry point was initially actually being in Johannesburg and teaching a variety of African students in the context of South African universities, students from all over Africa, not only South African students, and in sort of advanced English language programs and things like that. This was before I became a graduate student in the U.S. When I initially applied to graduate school, what I applied to do was to study the consumption of Korean soap operas in Zimbabwe. And in many ways, the student community that was my entry point into this question, around 2009, 2010, switched their personal interests from, you know, the consumption of the Korean wave, the Hallyu, as it is commonly known, they all started going to Confucius Institutes to take advantage of the expanded opportunities to go and study in China through Confucius Institutes and these sorts of educational initiatives in Africa. So in a sense, it was a question of trying to stick to my initial graduate program or to take a leap of faith and actually just in those prophetic words, follow the people, as it were. So I decided to go along with many of the African students to China and to enroll as another student in a Chinese university context and sort of explore the encounter between African students and their Chinese peers as somebody who is also trying to inhabit at least that educational position. And so I would say that rather than it being a fully conscious, rational choice, initially it was a matter of a piecemeal method-like commitment to inhabiting a subjectivity. You know, so if anthropologists are like actors, I guess I you could call it a bit of a method-style anthropologist. I don't know if as I get older this is going to be easier, but we shall see.
That's so fascinating. I had no idea that. I mean, Jay, I've known you probably 6-7 years. I had no idea that you had a different initiative before what you ended up doing for your PhD. And I wonder if that's something that's going to come up again, you know, later, or maybe if it did come up, you know, different times during your research, because obviously people's interest in soap operas don't necessarily disappear. But in Absolutely. The Anglo scene itself, yeah. But in Anglo scene, you investigate or you study this African and Chinese students' language and race-mediated interactions in the universities within Beijing's higher educational district, Haidian. Can you provide some background information to help our listeners contextualize your book? Who are the African educational migrants you grew to know and the Chinese ones, as you just mentioned, you were also working with faculty and Chinese students? And what kinds of aspirations did these students and the other interlocutors you got to know, what did they bring with them to China in these university spaces?
Okay, so this is actually a really great question because it actually allows an entry point into a few different things. But I think a good point to start with is why one would be interested in studying educational migrants as opposed to other kinds of migrants. And there's a very important difference there. You know, like with perceptions of migrants and migrancy, like whether it's China or Europe, you know, there's often this idea of the terminal migrant, right? A person who is a migrant and they are unable to move beyond that position. Now, we use that term, but it's actually cryptotypically suggests a sort of classed position of outsiderness, you know, and it is usually one where we perceive these folks by virtue of their mobility to be somehow trapped, which is kind of an interesting contradiction, right? But with educational migrancy, it's an interesting type of thing, because we expect in our valuations of education generally, especially cosmopolitan education, as a kind of a commensurative space-time through which we become somebody else or transform, that we expect that type of migrant not to be terminally a migrant, but to change or transform somehow through the educational initiative. 1 year, 2 year, 3 years of education is supposed to make you a new person in some ways. So what one's dealing with when you are dealing with something like an educational migrant is a type of migrant who is actually expected to change. So there is already the weight of expectation to transform somehow. So transforming into what becomes the kind of question for a lot of these migrants. Now, if you have African educational migrants going to, let's say, Europe or Oxbridge and the Ivy Leagues, you know, these sorts of spaces, there is already some kind of notion of what that subject is supposed to become or who that subject is supposed to become. Who that subject was supposed to become in the Chinese context was not so clear. And that's why it became a really compelling research question, because African subjects had to kind of think about who they wanted to be in the absence of an icon of personhood as to what the end product of a Chinese education should look like. And in a sense, it was curious watching the movement of African students into the Chinese space, trying to improvise the idea or improvise with the idea of an alternative Chinese modernity, and then often either being disappointed or inspired by their Chinese interlocutors, who themselves, many Chinese students, seem to be committed to Western educational modernity. Leading a lot of African students to ask, you know, why did I come all the way here if you are going there? So that's pretty crucial, I think, in these interactional dynamics.
Thank you. That was great. And that really was a fantastic entry point, because that really highlights a lot of the key themes that you're studying in your book. The book itself is divided into two parts, personhood and compromise. And the first three chapters, you describe personhood through a discursive approach that takes into consideration Sino-African post-socialist and post-colonial translations. And translations is really key here. In chapter one, you describe the Anglo scene and its pragmatic dimensions through chronotopes, signs and icons of value. Can you give our listeners a brief overview of how the broader domain of the Anglo scene and the English language entails particular affordances of subjectivity?
That's great. I mean, I think you're also picking up on the tension here with the translational analytic, as I use it in the book, right? So if we want to understand the Anglo scene and language in operation let's say Anglo scene as a kind of space-time that encompasses signs of language and racialization and certainly intersectional affordances, you know, within it. What we need to understand is how signs are put together in that sense. And I think the analytic of the chronotope, which is drawn from Mikhail Bakhtin, a Russian semiotician and theorist of language and history, in a sense becomes a really important consideration when we think about translation in general. Translation, when we think in its language metaphors, right? You're thinking of converting meanings from one thing into another. There's a sort of one, two kind of thinking in that. But what we forget is that in order to transform any meaning or to create sort of a conception of what one meaningful set means in another context, you actually need a third space. You need to create a third space, which is that space of translation. Some people have referred to it even as you need a third language, which is a trans language, something through which the meanings of one thing become intelligible in the context of another. And that's a really interesting type of proposition, because let's say the metaphor that one could use is, how would you communicate squares in a world of triangles, right? You could arrange the triangles in a square, you know, but that requires a conception of the arrangement of things outside of both of those contexts of translation. So the other way we talk about it is like a matrix and a target language. If you are, the matrix language is the one you're trying to translate, target language is what you're trying to translate it into. And for this very reason, I mean, post-colonial theorists have been concerned for a very long time with the idea that when you're engaging in any translational act, it is not only the context into which you are translating that changes, but it is the context of translation that changes too. And it's for this reason, it's for the fact of that third space of translation that is necessary in that sense. So if we're looking at Anglo scene, it is neither English nor is it race, but it is signs of Englishness and raceness as they become used or pragmatically recruited in social interaction. So in that sense, I'm also going against the translational intuition there's an alternative translational intuition, and it's that because things cannot be translated, therefore translation is invalid or nihilistic in some ways. I would challenge a lot of that type of bourgeois thinking. In the context of especially multilingual countries and multilingual nations, within which people actually have to commit to translation, even if it fails, every day. So we have to take the pragmatics of translation really seriously in a lot of these types of social interactions. And for that reason, as incomplete and as perspectival as something like an Anglo-Scene seems, it is nonetheless a useful category to think with when we try to understand what the proposition of English does and the potential worlds it permits a recruitment into an interaction.
Thank you so much, Jay. That was really fascinating. And it reminded me of one of the quotes that you, I mean, I have it written down here, one of the quotes from the first chapter, which you highlight. China must often work through English translation when engaging other non-Western interlocutors. I thought this was really crucial and something that I'd never really considered, even though I spent the majority of my life in China, I'd never really thought of it in that way. So thank you so much for bringing this to my perspective.
But actually you're picking up on something there, Suvi, because I mean, this goes back to, you know, this wasn't actually going to come up in this talk today, but it goes back to the Bandung moment to a certain extent. We forget that in the 1950s, you know, like when the non-Western world was decolonizing and engaging in discussions with one another about what that decolonization should look like, that English was very much on the table as a non-white expedient register of exchange. As long as white bodies are not present in that sort of situation, you know, English is very useful for subjects who are trying to communicate with one another in a sort of decolonial space time.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for bringing that historical element as well, which you do unpack in the introduction. At least it is relevant to the study. So let's move on to chapter two. Can you tell us a bit about some of the ways that the Anglo-Scene is sustained performatively through an intersectional domain that takes gender, race, and mobility into consideration?
Okay, so the intersectional domain was something that, like, I found almost something that could not be ignored in my field site, and also in. Let's say in a lot of contemporary recruitments of liberalism as not necessarily an emancipatory political horizon, but actually a classed horizon of aspiration, where, you know, notions of the gender emancipatory possibilities of let's say, the figure that comes up in that chapter is Sheryl Sandberg, you know, the lean in sort of moment. When you have this type of proposition being circulated in a context in China where a very curated language of gender equality has certain class dynamics, it necessarily excludes every single other vector of inequality. So that you actually find, and this is sort of beyond the scope of the book, but something that came up a lot during the fieldwork, you actually find a lot of, let's say, working class Chinese women feeling highly excluded by this kind of register, which is almost always, even when it's in Chinese, it still cryptotypically proposes English language based notions of lean-in or capitalist feminist discourses, you know, in a way that's very exclusionary, not only to working class women, but also ethnic minority women who are class stratified in this very context. So a way in which commitment to one horizon of identity ultimately excludes one from a number of other vectors of it. This seems extremely close to what Kimberly Crenshaw was speaking about in her famous Mapping the Margins essay, as well as the discussion of intersectionality before it, the 1989 essay. So in a sense, this was a point of engagement, and it allowed me an opportunity to think about, more recently, myself and a collaborator, Josh Babcock, brought out a a special issue on the semiotics of intersectionality, and another one we're going to bring out in the Journal of Linguistic Anthropology. But it was that moment in chapter two, actually, that prompted me down the road, or prompted me to think, in terms of, how should I put this? The interactional dynamics of intersectionality as Kimberly Crenshaw lays it out. So in Crenshaw's famous essays, right, you know, she's actually thinking about the context of American legal reform and the ways in which vectors of identity operate within the American juridical system, right? One vector that is not considered in that, because America is largely constituted as a kind of monolingual public, even if there are a number of different languages in operation in the US, right? Language is never considered as one of the intersectional vectors. But if you go to places like China, or, you know, certainly places like India and South Africa, language is super important as an identity stratifier. You know, you are as marked in many of these places through how you use language and what languages you are able to access and how you pronounce or speak them, as you are by the color of your skin or the ways in which you might be understood to have a sexual or gender identity. The question becomes, why is language so peculiarly left out in Anglo-centric settings? And it actually takes going to the periphery of that type of question to see it. You need to go to a place like China and ask, well, language is such an issue here in a country that's like, I wouldn't say China is like the poster, you know, the poster child for like multilingualism. Is actually not a very multilingual kind of, and the multilingualisms that exist are largely formulated through the publics of Putonghua. But even in Putonghua, there is a notion that Chinese is a language among languages, and that languages are stratified in relation to one another. Whereas there is a total, almost Lockean erasure of this concept in much of the Anglosphere. Entering language as a vector of intersectionality was a really key consideration in that chapter, and also showing how what might seem to be emancipatory horizons of unmarked aspiration ultimately come to compromise the very subjects who are unable to escape being marked in that representational economy.
This moves us to the next chapter, the third chapter, which I, in addition to all the other chapters, but I really thoroughly enjoyed this one. It's called Who Can Be a Racist? And you explore the role that humor and references to Oprah Girls and Trevor Noah Boys reveals the interplays between race and language through what you describe as a PC theater of evaluation. So this is kind of a continuation of what you were just telling our listeners about the kind of what liberalism, the workings of liberalism. And you conclude by suggesting that, here I'm quoting you, the question of what racism can be and who can be a racist remains constrained by its still Anglo-centric medium of translation. Can you tell us a bit more about this, please, Jay?
Sure. Okay, so I was... I had a sort of different response for this in mind initially, but I was just reminded of the ways in which we can think about, Anglo-centric liberalism, is a really key consideration here. So a lot of folks would, especially in the US, where I did my graduate studies and as a sort of folk intuition, would understand liberalism to be a sort of transcendent political theology, in a sense, you know, as much as anything else is, you know, but it is highly marked in terms of its linguistic features, so that even when subjects invoke it outside of that context or outside of an English context, they nonetheless often invoke many of these terms with an Anglosphere or Anglo-scenic context in mind, you know, so that to the degree that when subjects want to, and I've certainly seen this in the South African context and the Chinese context, when subjects want to deviate from liberalism, a language switch is a very effective way of doing that, because it's already assumed that the appropriate politically correct public of English is a very different one from an appropriately politically correct public in another language. So that when subjects want to indulge in racist or gendered or misogynistic speech, recourse to another language is a quick way to do that. And when criticisms emerge, they're like, oh, but, you know, it's not the same thing, you know, as this sort of ultimately alienating liberal domain of English, you know, to a large extent. So trying to account for the ways in which there is a linguistic particularity and a sort of chronotopic particularity to liberal discourse, even in places where, you know, the presiding language ideology itself is not expected to be English, you know, was a sort of key consideration. You know, how do we teleport a liberal public into an interaction? And the question of who can be racist emerges particularly prominently, because it suggests that, like, considerations of liberalism are far from unmarked. And ultimately, in subjects' recruitments of liberal ideologies and their actions, as a register of bringing in this horizon of unmarkedness or unmarked subjectivity, ultimately end up hypermarking themselves in that, through that interaction. So in that chapter, you have several instances of subjects invoking politically correct language and contesting politically correct language in a context outside of the West, but certainly in terms of that horizon of aspiration that has English characteristics.
Thank you so much, Jay. Okay, let's move on to the fourth chapter. And this is the beginning of the second theme of your book, compromise. So we've moved from personhood to compromise. And here you go beyond spoken language to consider the translational technology in Afro-Chinese encounters through the mass and socially mediated recruitment of nature as metaphor. The Anglo-Scene becomes a zone of translation and site for the alienating collaboration of affective fields of sensual social life. Can you tell us a bit more about this through the metaphor of nature, which you describe through ethnography in your chapter?
That's great. Because the question there, right, in that particular chapter was one of how nature is racialized and how race or racial difference is construed through that category of nature to a certain extent, right? So it emerged in the fieldwork when a subject, a Chinese ethnographic subject, was referring to African subjects' closeness to nature in a kind of romantic sense. Now, when confronted with this ethnographic vignette, a number of sinologists read it and thought to themselves, oh my goodness, but this is not racism at all. This is merely just, you know, somebody like attributing aesthetically appropriate naturalistic features as a contrast to, you know, robotic Chinese society in some sense. So ultimately, being close to nature is a good thing, you know, in this sort of scenario. But I had to take a sort of seek reference, and I think I'm going to take recourse to the book, around page 119, 120. Let me quickly pull it out. So the How Paper Tigers Kill chapter, right? It's on page 122, where I look at an extract in Michael Sullivan's discussion of an infamous letter to African embassies in Beijing sent on behalf of the Chinese Students Association in 1989. It is an example that demonstrates this cryptotypic articulation of race and nature handily. So in this 1989 letter, the Chinese Students Association wrote the following. China, whose thousand-year glory and cultural tradition is ineffaceably written in the history of mankind, stands today because of the great Xiaoping's merit in front of a new historical prime.
We are walking towards our great aim on a broad road opened to the advanced and civilized world. It doesn't mean, however, that we will feed the whole uncultured Africa with the results of our efforts, and we will allow any Negro to hang about our universities to annoy Chinese girls and to introduce on our academic grounds manners acquired by life in tropical forests, offending our traditional hospitality and broad-mindedness. If there will be no correction in the behavior of idling black students, new and even harder lessons of friendship will follow. They, these lessons, will be based on the experience of Americans who know very well what to do to curb the Negroes in their country. I mean, even in 1989, like the association of nature and African subjects or black subjectivity is a far from benign and romantic consideration. Now, I mean, if a lot of scholars do seek recourse to Qing and Ming texts, you know, but I would argue that signs are not consistently, you know, they don't signify one thing at a time, like all the time, you know, in a fundamental sense. So the association of nature and blackness could be construed in benign ways, but it can certainly be construed in the types of violent ways that we see here. And so a large part of the book, and I think a large part of my critique of a lot of contemporary Sinology, is to situate China in the world, where Chinese subjects in their attitudes and relationships to others do conceptualize the world as a participation framework, particularly a highly mediated society like that of the US, you know, ways in which sort of white racist tropes are translated into Chinese by a number of highly masculinist Chinese netizens, certain forms of misogynistic turn, you know, in the trolling of female activists in China, you know. These are not quintessentially emerging from like the deep archive of historical Chinese experience. They are also engaging a world beyond China. So China is as much in the world as the world is in China in many of these terms. So I would warn against the easy relativisms within which we read these associations in the let's say Sinological archive in China. Yeah. So that was the purpose of that chapter to a large extent. I'm so happy that you picked up on that, because it was something that was that has been a very prominent bugbear on the job market before the book came out. You know, I encountered a lot of hostility in Sinological audiences who claimed that there was no racism in China, and that blackness and nature were not an association worthy of consideration. So thank you for that entry point.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's remarkable that you would be faced with this. I mean, in any circumstance, obviously, but especially in the job market, especially considering the number of years you've committed to studying the topic, and also you being an African in China, seeing it from a completely different perspective, and then people telling you, you know, first of all, being a South African in South Africa, but then removing yourself from that as well, to be confronted with that kind of comment just seems Very surprising.
Shocking. It's surprising, but it indicates the binaristic ways in which disciplines like Sinology have been constructed. It must be a West and its others kind of conception, or it must be a China versus America conception. There's no one outside of that participation framework. Is so prominently the assumption, you know, in there. Whereas the world is a very big place, I would say to both of these sets of audiences. And if the world is a very big place, maybe the gestures and signs we assume to have canonical meanings are somewhat more nuanced within a very vast space-time.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for that. And thank you for referring straight from your book. It's such a privilege to have the author speak direct, like quote from the book. It was just really pleasant to listen to you read. Okay, let's move on to chapter 5. This one is titled Ubuntu and Guanxi. Chapter 5 ethnographically explores the pragmatics of translation between Ubuntu and Guanxi. Can you tell us a bit more about the pragmatics of translation of these terms, and why is an important empirical starting point to decolonizing the study of non-Western, non-Anglo-centric interactions?
Okay, that's great. And we did sort of touch on this earlier on in thinking about the Anglo scene and its relationship and its imbricated relationship between English and language. But I want to sort of explore this a little bit more deeply. So what I meant to say by the pragmatics of translation is very much a move, and I think I sort of set it up in that chapter. It's very much a move against what I would call the maybe the root of the problem, you know, is semanticism around translation. So if we understand the conventional position in the social sciences around an analytic of translation, it's usually one where translation is something that we're trying to define, right? Translation is X, or translation is Y, you know, or translation is not, you know, to a certain extent, translation is semantically impossible in that sense, therefore unuseful, you know, and in that sense. In a lot of these cases, they often find themselves in a peculiar scenario where they need to presume translation in order to define it, right? Which is obviously the usual sort of problem semantically. By a pragmatics, what we're doing is, rather than presuming A, what translation is, and B, entering into the hall of mirrors where anything can become everything or not, let's call it analytical or semantic debate. What we're asking is, what do the affordances of translation do? Because it turns out people make use of translation. People translate. They actually do this thing that we are referring to. Now, we can presume what it means, or we can look what they are doing with this thing we call translation. There is indisputably something called translation that people refer to in their everyday lives as they are doing it. No amount of metaphysical jargon is going to alienate subjects from these acts and activities, you know, to a large extent. Subjects are also in this process going to notice things like cultural terms or cultural difference. Now, the two subjects in that chapter, Professor Lee and I think is it Patrice in that chapter, you know, in both cases, they are trying to use culture concepts like Guanxi and Ubuntu. Neither of them is an anthropologist, an expert in cultural terms, nor is either of them, you know, a sort of like entering into the deep archives of how these concepts and terms were constructed through ethnographic or anthropological knowledge. They are using these as common sense terms that nonetheless have an enduring meaning for them as semiotic objects in the world that define a certain kind of behavior, right? And for that reason, they pragmatically engage in acts of translation. These are, unless one is truly so alienated from social life that one interprets every single social interaction as purely rational types of activities that require like narrow definitions of every single concept and term, which most people are not, you are probably going to hedge a translation in the ways that Patrice and Professor Lee are doing here. And it's trying to account for the ways in which it's actually this kind of, again, piecemeal activity ultimately is certainly anthropologists or historians or sort of any kind of sort of cultural curator will look at their behavior and say, but this is neither Guanxi nor Ubuntu. Ultimately, it's subjects like these that sustain the meanings of these terms as meaningfully anthropological concepts for us. It is subjects who are reflexively and pragmatically making use of cultural ideas and terms that sustains our study of them, which in a weird way is a sort of, it's not in a weird way, I guess. It's a way of bringing our discussions back to the pragmatics of interactions within which anthropology's cultural terms emerge. A sense in which we're trying to make anthropological thought relevant, you know, in contexts where it could so easily be branded as romantically culturally appropriative type of, as a romantically culturally appropriative type of discipline. You know, we are showing like, There is a real impetus for anthropology's sort of cultural sensitivity, particularly in situations where, guess what, everybody's an expert on culture these days, except from anthropologists.
Yeah. and just for our listeners who might not be familiar with these terms, Guanxi and Ubuntu, can you just very briefly tell the listeners what are they referring to, or what are Mr. Lee and Patrice referring to in your chapter?
So in a more generalistic sense, I would focus on how they are defining the terms as subjects who are using them to a certain extent. Yeah. We're dealing with an intersubjective sensibility of assuming that through a interhuman connection between a subject, I can only be somebody through others. Now, this is not a strange idea, really. I mean, it emerges, I mean, even in sort of narrow social science context through the work of somebody like Irving Goffman, you know, his understanding that you could perform who you are all you like, but it requires somebody on the other end to ratify your performance, to allow you to be who you want to be. You know, and this is at the heart of Gyatri Spivak's Can the Subaltern Speak? It's not necessarily about the subaltern's ability to say words or make sounds with them. It's actually about the capacity for those words to be heard and understood and contextualized, because otherwise there is no subject position to speak of. You may as well be discursively obliterated in an interaction if your interlocutor is not willing to recognize and ratify who you are. It's largely what's at stake in the politics of pronouns, which somebody like Jordan Peterson does not really understand. You actually need affordances for understanding in order for a subject position to emerge, not just the mere performance of them, because it's the old tree falling in a forest type of philosophical question there, you know. But Guanxi and Ubuntu are explicit cultural concepts and terms drawn respectively from China and Southern and broad and a lot of African context, but in my context, I'm using the sort of Southern African word for it, Ubuntu or Ubuntu, you know, to refer to this kind of sensibility of being somebody through others. And the ways in which this presumes
the building of social relations, the maintenance of ethical obligations between people towards one another. And it manifests itself through gift giving, through intersubjective leverage, and even through slightly more darker iterations, bullying and intersubjective subterfuge. But nonetheless, Guanxi and Ubuntu are great cultural concepts for picking up on this intersubjective contingency that subjects have in relation to one another.
Thank you so much for that clarification. Such a fascinating concept, and I'm guessing a lot of our listeners will be able to kind of resonate with that. I mean, it makes perfect sense that we recognize who we are according to if we get that recognition from others, or depending on who's listening, depending on who's watching. And I liked how you're kind of weaving that through Goffman's theory as well.
And Spivak's, you know, to a large extent. I mean,
Right.
But what's interesting there is the ways in which, you know, like we say this is common sense, you know, to a large extent. When we say it like this it is commonsensical, yet so many of our let's call it like large scale media regulation institutions have very peculiar understandings of communication and communicative encounter. You know, the idea, for instance, you know, like let's go at the most macro sort of level. If you go and look at, and it's one of the examples I used to teach with, go look at the NASA SETI program, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, right? Is there a single communications or linguist person on that panel? No. And the idea is largely that putting information on a golden disk and sending it out to space, like we're putting a lot of faith in the aliens' capacity to decode, you know, even while our own social intuitions suggest that it takes a hell of a lot of context to get a message across.
<You know? laughs> That's such a fantastic example.
You know, at the sort of intersubjective intuitive level, we all agree. But it turns out on our sort of macro institutional levels, there's some very strange ideas about how communication works and society operates.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, it's also we're driven. I mean, a lot of kind of neoliberal institutions drive us to think forward in that way, that we are, you know, the very individualistic, kind of more self-centered subjectivity that doesn't necessarily who knows who they are rather than is given that recognition from their peers. Yeah, if we move on to the next chapter, again, I really enjoyed how you formed the chapter, and I liked how you moved closer to the conclusion in chapter 6. I mean, it is the conclusion of your book, where you explicitly remind the reader how your ethnography, again, I'm quoting you, captures the ideological conditions that both obstruct and perpetuate the fantasy of equal opportunism, unquote. By linking it back to your own experiences as a South African in the American higher educational setting, I thought that this was just really, really fantastic and also very moving. And it was just you show your own kind of sentimental side here, and it was just moving to read. You apply this your experiences, looking at the political environment that you saw unfolding around you from the Obama era to Trump's presidency, and then later post Trump or what we are at the moment. And one of my favorite quotes in the chapter is, again, I'm quoting you, is whiteness in the ways I have demonstrated does not need white bodies. Can you expand on this statement? What does it mean, so our listeners can understand?
That's great. And it's also great that you picked up on that in that chapter. I will also just as a sort of contextualizing move say that like doing a chapter like this is not something they will tell you to do in graduate school or something they will tell you to do as part of your ethnography. But it's something that I thought ethically I was compelled to do. I mean, if we really do embrace the sort of anthropological imperative of being reflexive. We should be reflexive about the ethnographic act, the act about writing itself, because as I recently suggested to a class of students who are doing field methods, the field's place of beginning and ending is not very clear. It's very ambiguous. But I would say a very good starting point is and ending point is the pen itself. Because ultimately, and it sort of emerged of over years of submitting drafts of papers and whatever to journals, right, and getting comments back about, and often the comments take all kinds of forms and shapes, as we know. But one thing that's really interesting is how reviewers, particularly in cultural anthropological journals or like broadly social science-y journals, will fixate on referring to vignettes and very curated ethnographic descriptions as empirical materials. And this is such an interesting language ideology, because they're not empirical like my field notes are or my recordings are, or like the totality of the vast set of materials that have piled up that you're actually drawing these bits and pieces from and curating in a very particular sort of way. You know, they're not immediate in that sense. And yet the whole point of a vignette or the arrangement is to create the illusion of immediacy. So we should really be reflexive about the fact that we're already at the analysis point here. We have already extracted something from experience, converted it into a paper model, and brought it into the paper world of the social sciences, mediated through the Anglo-centric register of academic English, to have a debate with other kinds of intellectual objects being modeled within that paper world. We have moved very far away from the empirical materials. That's not to say they're unempirical. It's all empirical. But to make but when you're presuming the division, what you're talking about is immediacy. And yes, they feel immediate, but they're not immediate at all. And ethically, this sort of compels us as ethnographers to say, like, look, the writing of this and the contextualizing of this and who I'm speaking to needs to be recognized. We need to break that fourth wall. If we're going to do it according to these sort of often emptily voice, even if they're sanctimoniously framed imperatives in ethnography, really going to do that, then we must be reflexive about how and for whom we were writing this, and under what conditions we were writing this, these materials. It is crucial. You cannot leave it out. Now, to get to the term that emerged in there, whiteness in the ways I've demonstrated does not need white bodies. I mean, largely as a South African and being increasingly in these weird alienated spaces of like working on race and black students in China and then encountering like the categories of identity and difference within the US, I increasingly found myself finding deep wisdom in African thinkers, you know, like Fanon and Steve Biko, none of whom, like, they are often branded as subjects who are essentializing race. They understood the kind of epistemic weight of race in many of these ways. They understood that race presences itself, and that's somebody like Charles Mills too, who's a severely underrated critical race theorist. You know, race presences itself in your life in different ways depending on how you are situated into it. That does not mean you are that thing, you know, but you are made to be it, you know, in a certain sense. But if you look at all of Fanon and Biko's examples, they're often examples of subjects who may not be white at all, you know, necessarily benefiting from or drawing on the racial capital of whiteness in this sense. And if from that conceptual move, the racial capital of whiteness is portable, recruitable, and especially it is so in places where, let's say, white bodies are not present, then it does suggest that, you know, you don't necessarily need white bodies in order to have whiteness as a structuring ideology. Let's say in this sense, you know, the weirdly narcissistic ethic where I recall a recent American social scientist was teaching a critical race class and explaining that, you know, like white subjects have done such terrible things that they just actually shouldn't reproduce and shouldn't be subjects in the world. This is actually oddly quite racist, not against whites, you know, because it suggests that the only ways that you'll ever defeat whiteness is if they commit sort of like suicide. I'd be willing to admit that if there wasn't a Caucasian body in sight, whiteness would still be a problem within these dynamics of racial capital that we see operating in the world at present. I would say even for let's say right-wing white subjects, and I've seen this in apartheid South Africa, particularly with Afrikaans subjects, my own ethnic group, that a large part of the anti-black racism is significant issues with not feeling white enough, with feeling like a waste of a white skin if you haven't significantly lived up to the unmarked potential of white subjectivity. So, and the pursuit of unmarkedness itself is a sort of cryptotypic pursuit of the kind of racial capital where you no longer have to worry about being stratified through race. That is an apex position. That is not a general position of equity. So let's always ask ourselves, who are the subjects who can feel unmarked, you know, in a social encounter? Those are subjects who do not have to worry about being stratified through how they appear or what their appearances or what kind of economy their appearances might be weaponized into. Yeah, I guess that's what I was getting at.
It's such a powerful message. I mean, it's just, and again, I really love how you kind of build up to that in your final chapter. It's just, it's really, the book is really beautifully compiled and the structure really works. I mean, I can only imagine that that's something that required a lot of time and effort and thinking. It doesn't, you know, but putting it together, a structure is one of the most difficult elements of putting together the book itself.
That's true. I would totally agree. But I'm also so absolutely grateful that somebody picks up on these things, you know, and says that, you know, because, you know, there can be so many responses to it. And the responses, you're like sometimes, oh shit, you know, that was exactly the reading I was trying to avoid, you know, but largely, I mean, like I'm kind of like just grateful that folks like yourself are picking up on these parts and these dimensions of what's being conveyed. So I can't thank you enough for reading the book and for engaging its ideas so eloquently. So yeah, I'm extremely grateful.
It was my pleasure, and I can assure you many other readers will also pick up on these same points and many more. I'm not a linguistic anthropologist, so I struggled a lot with the linguistic anthropology stuff, but the technical bits were, yeah, but I mean, as I was saying, how you it's a beautiful flow and it really does work, and the way it goes, you know, how you're moving to the bigger argument or moving to that more familiar anthropological discussion of positionality and so forth. And then you frame it in a way that's kind of, it's just, it really fits and it's really smart because you're also putting it together through your own experiences in the American educational system and the political climate that you were living in America. And so many other readers will also pick up on that, I can assure you.
Okay, great.
Yeah. But thank you. I really enjoyed the book. But before we finish today's show, I want to ask you about what you're working on and thinking about these days. I mean, Anglocene was, it just came out. I mean, it's 2023, so it came out, I think, January, February. Again, massive congratulations. And maybe this question's a bit it's a bit too sudden, too abrupt. But what have you been working on? I mean, you've been in China, you've been teaching, but have you been able to pick up on any projects or continue something that you haven't been able to commit to because Anglocene was taking up probably most of your working life until quite recently?
Well, actually, you know, I mean, like thinking about Anglocene and putting it out there, you know, it was sort of a strange experience because it has been a long time working on the book and getting it out. But from the ways in which I was situating myself in the book and thinking about the book, I've actually moved on to quite a number of different concerns. You know, also being a person who's working in China while doing research here, my follow-up work is interestingly a little different. I would also say readers of the next book will not be able to pick up so much on the types of enregistered linguistic element as much. The next book is going to be about, and I'm loosely framing it around this title, we'll see if it will undergo changes, Synesthetic China. And it's basically about the use of history, the pragmatics of history. So as we were talking about the sort of pragmatics of translation, the pragmatics of race, it's the ways in which heritage and history become usable and portable to institutions, people, and subjects trying to find a way to negotiate a very precarious world through their synesthetic recruitments of historical objects and historical space-time in one way or another. So I'm working on some chapters and some ideas and some ethnographic concepts and trying to get some funding together for all of that. But thinking about, Anglesey was thinking about, like, you know, how terms like how semiotic formations like race and language are stratified in contexts, recruiting time. I'm actually thinking about how time itself is rendered portable to us as subjects, and how this has very much stakes for our political engagements of every life, but just for our abilities to live as a sort of time traveling species, as humans. The human as time traveler, virtually or otherwise.
That sounds so fascinating. I had no idea you were working on this, and I can't wait to hear more about the chapters you've already been compiling, what kind of material it's based around. And I'm sure our listeners also very much look forward to hearing more about how it unfolds. But for now, Jay, I want to thank you. For now, I want to thank you so much for putting time aside and joining me to talk about your work. It's been such a fascinating conversation. It's such a thought-provoking book. Listeners, you can actually grab, you can get a free access to the book itself on the University of California Press's Open Access Publishing Program. So if you visit the Luminos page, www.luminosa.org, listeners will be able to access the book in open access form.
Absolutely. And that was really important, actually, for me, especially as somebody who works in China, and my students and many of the publics that I had in mind when I was writing the book were not American and European readers. I mean, these are the subjects that usually are the sort of target audiences for the big presses, right? But they were Chinese and African students who don't often have like $30, $34 or something to spend on a book. So I was lucky that my institution, Zhejiang University, was willing to pay the subvention fee to get it to be open access and downloadable by students in China and in the rest of the world alike. So there is a reason it is open access and why we're committed to doing this. In many sense, since the book was written precisely recruiting that, or as, and I'm sure you picked up on that in reading it, it was written precisely with that audience in mind. It was not just speaking to the Euro-American audience, but definitely to a broader one.
Absolutely. Well, massive shout out, big thank you to Zhejiang University. I mean, it's so important that universities everywhere are supporting authors for open access, but especially in this case. Thank you, Zhejiang University. Thank you, Jay, for making this happen. but thank you so much, Jay, for tuning in. It's been a pleasure. I've had so much fun.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Sivi. You're a great host for this show, and I thoroughly enjoyed these questions, so engaged and so connected with the material. You know, it's really, really was fabulous. Thank you.
It's really been my pleasure to read it. Thank you so much to listeners for tuning into New Books in Chinese Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Have a great week, everyone. Bye-bye.